Tuesday, August 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, at the start of a White House briefing Monday, President Trump was quickly whisked off the stage.
I said, can I get back now? And they said, yes.
Lebanon's prime minister resigns after a weekend of violent outrage over last week's devastating explosion that gutted Beirut.
Something needs to break. We need to move on. We cannot stay as where we are.
Also ahead, tensions continue to head toward a boiling point between the U.S. and China. It's all on today's International Edition. Monday's coronavirus update briefing at the White House was pretty unusual, as no sooner did President Donald Trump take to the podium in the briefing room was he abruptly escorted out by a U.S. Secret Service agent.
They just wanted me to step aside for a little while just to make sure that everything was cleared outside because it was right in this area.
White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joins us with an update. Steve, what happened?
Yes, this was a really remarkable scene, Lori. The president taken from the podium, and he said he was taken to the Oval Office, while the Secret Service dealt with a security situation. The president then returning to the briefing room lectern a few minutes later and explaining that there was an actual shooting and somebody had been taken to the hospital. And one of the reporters who was at the White House was actually asked by the president what he had heard later in the news conference. And John Roberts, who's with Fox News, said he heard two shots in rapid succession just after you took the podium. That's what he told the president from his seat in the Brady briefing room.
So what is the Secret Service saying about what happened?
Yes, we don't have a lot of information, Lori, about what exactly happened. What we do know is that there was, according to the Secret Service, an officer-involved shooting at 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. That's quite close to the White House. And that the Secret Service says a male subject and one of its officers were both transported to a local hospital. And the Secret Service is emphasizing at no time during this incident was the White House complex breached or were any protectees in danger.
But a Secret Service officer is hospitalized?
The officer was taken to the hospital. We don't know if there was an injury during a scuffle or if that person possibly had been shot or stabbed. The president said he had been told by agents that subject who was shot had a gun, but that is not confirmed at this time by the Secret Service.
How unusual is something like this? How unprecedented is this?
So very unusual to see the president, while he was live on television, have somebody come up to him, whisper in his ear, and then have him walk out of the room. We do have lockdowns at the White House quite frequently when there is some sort of security breach or a threat of one, and then everybody has to hold inside until we get the all clear. So that has happened before, but I don't recall one happening while the president was at the briefing podium, alive on television, and then had to leave the room.
White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thank you so much. The United States set a record for coronavirus cases Saturday with more than 5 million people now infected. The country has recorded more than 160,000 deaths, nearly a quarter of the world's total. Global coronavirus cases pushed past 20 million Monday, with the U.S., Brazil, and India accounting for more than half of all known infections. The World Health Organization says the respiratory disease has infected at least four times the average number of people struck down with severe influenza illnesses annually. Lebanon's government has resigned after last week's devastating explosion in Beirut and reports of negligence by the country's officials, which unleashed a wave of public anger that added to months of unrest in the country and calls for the government to resign.
We need a total change in the country. The country is run by a corrupt gang of people, all helping each other. I mean, they are dividing the cake between each other. In appearance, they might be enemies, but in fact, they're all supporting each other.
As Ankal Vohra reports from Beirut, the resignation of the country's prime minister and his cabinet, though, come as many Lebanese fear that hundreds of millions of dollars in international aid could end up in the pockets of the same politicians whom they hold responsible for the catastrophe.
Thousands of protesters returned to downtown Beirut, the epicenter of protests which first began in October, and said they have had enough. Some called not only for the removal of the political class, but demanded the politicians be hanged. Many Lebanese accused the leadership of ignoring the warnings to dispose of the thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate that caused the explosion. The gigantic explosion left more than 150 dead, 5,000 injured, and as many as 250,000 homes destroyed. Leda Hakim volunteered to clean the streets. She tied a noose to her broom.
This is the broom that I've been using to clean up the houses and the streets of the people who lost everything. And the noose is for the government that has killed us all, not just the people who died, but all of us, everyone living in Lebanon.
Shortly after Saturday's demonstration began, security forces fired tear gas at protesters who tried to break the cordon around the parliament building. The protesters succeeded in storming the foreign ministry to vent their anger against the establishment. As the evening progressed, uniformed men beat some of the protesters and cleared them from the streets. Undeterred, the protesters were back the next day. The protesters want an international panel to investigate the explosion, saying they have no trust in their government. 21-year-old Izar Lahoud came out with his friends. He said he wants politicians dead or thrown out of the country.
They are not thinking about us. They are thinking about their own duties and their self, how to make money. But we are dying here. No politician cares.
The international community is pledging millions in aid. But in a country where graft and mismanagement had already sparked months of unrest before the disaster, there is fear that the money may end up in the pockets of corrupt politicians. Anshul Vora for VOA News, Beirut.
Police in Belarus used stun grenades, tear gas, and water cannon in a crackdown on thousands of protesters who took to the streets of Minsk late Sunday, as exit polls showed President Alexander Lukashenko winning about 80% of the vote, while his main challenger had about 7%. International Edition's Steve Miller gets an update from Charles Maines in Moscow.
This election was supposed to be the most challenging of longtime Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko's career, or it appeared to be until the results came in. The official results say that Lukashenko won 80% of the vote, with just 10% going to his most serious challenger. That's Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. She's a housewife who entered this race only because her husband, a popular political blogger and would-be candidate, was denied the ballot and thrown in jail. Now, Tikhanovskaya attracted huge crowds in the run-up to election day, and which made this result of 10% look even more suspicious. She's come out today and says she rejects the results. They have, she says, proof that many just the opposite was true, that she won many of these precincts, and she's appealing to the Electoral Commission. As you noted, thousands came out on the streets last night. Dozens were injured in a tense standoff with Lukashenko's riot troops in central Minsk and also some other cities around the country. You know, many will say this was actually quite predictable, that first of all, that Lukashenko would win. He controls the election apparatus. And they also say the protests were predictable. These were huge rallies. People basically were waiting to happen.
Poland, Germany, and others have come out saying that the election didn't meet standards. So what can the EU effectively do in this case?
Well, that's right. The EU condemned what they called disproportionate and unacceptable state violence against peaceful protesters. They called for a fair count. But the truth is, they probably can do very little. I mean, Belarus is also, Lukashenko, I should say, has often played this kind of game between East and West. He's used Belarus's sort of foreign policy as his bargaining chip, where sometimes he drifts into Russia's orbit. And when it's convenient, he sort of drifts towards Europe. But, you know, I think what's interesting here is the protesters themselves say they don't want a street revolution. They want an honest count. But Lukashenko really has given them little choice but to go out onto the streets. And so we're stuck in this showdown between the state security apparatus and a very, very united opposition at this point. I think it's also worth pointing out here that while Lukashenko has faced challenges before and come out ahead, frankly, he's been in power now for 26 years, the only post-Soviet president Belarus is really known. You know, this time people say it's different. And the reason is the COVID pandemic. Lukashenko, people might remember, he paid really little heed to the global pandemic. He mocked it as essentially mass hysteria. And as the body count went up and people got infected and people were having shortages of equipment at hospitals around the country, you know, it wasn't the government that helped out. It was civil society. People stepped in to fill the void. And I think what they did came out of that was this lesson that they don't need Lukashenko and they're working around him. And that seems to be one of the conclusions that people have come to, that he may have the post as president or the title officially, but in their eyes, he's no longer their leader.
What can you tell us about Natalia Shklerov, who's kind of been held in somewhat of a loose connection with all this?
He's a political consultant. He's worked in campaigns both in the U.S. and in Russia, frankly. I've met him and interviewed him before. But he is a Belarus national, a native of Minsk originally, and he was arrested late last month and held for 60 days. Now, last week, you know that there was a court case held on August 4th, a hearing in which the court rejected calls to release him. But they've also yet to present any formal charges that we know of. And in theory, that means they would have to release him, even if he remains a suspect in the eyes of the state. But again, I think it's worth noting that in Alexander Lukashenko's Belarus, the state really determines the rules. There are formal rules, but they're not often observed. So we're waiting to see.
Charles Maines in Moscow speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Tensions between the U.S. and China continue to escalate. Monday, China imposed sanctions on 11 U.S. citizens, including legislators, in response to the U.S. imposition of sanctions on 11 Hong Kong and Chinese officials accused of curtailing political freedoms in the former British colony. Among those targeted were Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. Also Monday, Hong Kong media tycoon and democracy advocate became the highest profile person arrested under the new national security law. And Monday's actions follow the Trump administration's recent order for the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston, Texas, and China's retaliatory closure of the U.S. consulate in Chengdu. Joining us now to talk more about this troubled relationship is David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Thank you so much for being with us. Even before the actions on Monday, the recent consulate closures had some analysts suggesting that things were reaching a point of no return between these two major world powers. Do you agree that could be the case?
I think we have reached not only a new low in the relationship, but I do agree. I think we have reached a potentially dangerous inflection point. When countries start literally shutting down consulates, that is a different type of, just qualitatively, it's a different type of action. It's one thing to issue a blistering statement. It's another thing to answer a question in a press conference and use tough language. It's another to issue an executive order or pass legislation. But to literally shut down a consulate, as the United States administration did with respect to the Consulate General of China in Houston, and of course the Chinese reciprocated relative to the U.S. Consulate General in Chengdu, that starts to up the ante considerably. I found myself wondering whether this might be the first step toward formal U.S. derecognition of the People's Republic of China. Not saying that I expect that'll happen or that I believe it will happen. I'm not saying that what has happened so far is tantamount to that. But if the Trump administration were to want to go down the path of literally derecognizing the People's Republic of China and terminating the diplomatic relationship, starting by closing with a consulate would be a pretty natural place to start. And so I do think that it is literally unprecedented in the U.S.-China context. You just never see this type of thing happen typically outside the context of two countries that are about to fight a war with each other, where you might see countries evacuate their diplomatic personnel and shut down consulates or even the embassy. But in a time of peace, this is unprecedented. And I think it does take us a potentially very dangerous path. And I'm concerned about it.
There are reports that the Trump administration administration wants this escalation now ahead of re-election. He wants to be the president known for destroying the U.S.-China relationship.
I've seen that reporting and that analysis across discourse in this country. I think it is very plausible that that is the motivation. I've seen serious people from both political parties come to that conclusion. It's a reasonable conclusion to come to. I think that this administration clearly believes, as the Trump campaign believed in 2015 and 2016, that there is a broad national consensus around, quote, getting tough on China. And I think this administration seems to believe that doing all it can to manifest that toughness is probably very good politics at this stage of the 2020 race. You know, what's interesting about the closure of China's consul general in Houston is that virtually no public evidence has been presented by the administration to substantiate any of the claims that are made by the administration. It's one thing to say, look, here's the smoking gun. Here's the evidence. Here's why we're doing this. It's another thing to say that the evidence is merely the fact that we're saying that it is true. And what we're seeing is the latter. The administration is saying that the consulate did this and did that. And the administration is expecting that the mere fact that the administration has said that is sufficient evidence. But, you know, one particular example of this phenomenon that I'd point to is Senator Ted Cruz of Texas just wrote an op-ed, I think, in the Houston Chronicle that basically said good riddance to the consulate general in Houston, and then said that, in his words, quote, proof abounds, unquote, he used those words, as to, you know, why this consulate should have been shut down. And then in the rest of his 600-word piece, he offered not one single word, not one shred of proof or evidence tying the consulate to any nefarious or illegal or inappropriate activity. Not saying that the activity didn't happen, but no one has proved that it has. So that suggests to me that there may very well be an element of pure politics as part of the decision-making calculus in this case.
What are the dangers of pretty much destroy the relationship between the U.S. and China, the world's two largest economies? Why are you concerned?
I think the main danger of what I'm seeing now is that so many things have been done legislatively and by virtue of presidential executive order, agency-level policy change, and so on, that much of what has been done is going to be very hard to undo. There is a kind of ratcheting dynamic where this thing can move in one direction pretty easily, meaning U.S. posture toward China can become tougher and tougher and tougher and tougher rather easily. It becomes very difficult for a variety of reasons, including just the politics of the moment, public sentiment, the fact that we have an election, the fact that generally change is hard, the fact that it's tough for people to say, stand up and say, well, I'm going to campaign on undoing the tough on China policy framework. And so it tends to ratchet in one direction, and it tends to be irreversible, at least in the short term and often in the medium and long term. Just for example, under President George H.W. Bush, the United States adopted, I think very appropriately, sanctions on China in the wake of Tiananmen. 31 years later, those sanctions are all still in place. The most significant of them are still in place because once it's done, it becomes hard to undo. That irreversibility, I think, is one of the dangers. And then the only other thing I would say is that just more fundamentally and substantively, I think it really is in the U.S. interest to engage with the second largest economy in the world. Even today, under President Trump, we are still doing about $550 billion in two-way trade at a time when the relationship is horrible. Now, that's a little down from the peak of well over $600 billion in two-way trade. But the point being that even with all of this negativity, China is still America's third largest trading partner. It still accounts for many jobs in this country. It's still a very important player in the way that our economy functions and will be for some significant period of time into the future. And I just think disengaging from an economy of this size and from a global geopolitical player of China's stature undermines U.S. security interests and potentially hurts a significant swath of the American people economically.
David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Thank you for being with us. Greece's entire armed forces are on emergency alert following Turkey's decision to send a vessel to explore potential drilling sites off the coast of two Greek islands in the southeast Aegean Sea. The escalation comes after Greece and Egypt signed a maritime deal blocking Turkish access to the eastern Mediterranean, a move that has enraged Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, leading him to flex his country's muscle in a long-running territorial legal tussle. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Defense Ministry officials denied that reservists had been called up overnight as a result of the brewing crisis. Still, the same sources tell VOA that Greece's entire military apparatus is on red alert, monitoring Turkey's movements after the neighboring state launched naval drills east and south of the islands of Rhodes and Kastellorizo in the southeast Aegean Sea over the weekend. The drills include live fire, and most worrying for Greece, Ankara on Monday also sent out the vessel Oruç Reis to survey the continental shelf in an area in the eastern Mediterranean, which both Greece and Turkey consider their own. While both NATO allies, the two neighboring states, have been challenging each other's air and sea rights in the region for decades. The two countries came to the brink of war more than 20 years ago. Just last month, German Chancellor Angela Merkel weighed in on a fresh territorial tussle between the two, convincing President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to back off from sending the Oruç Reis on a similar expedition in the same region. Both sides agreed to a moratorium, promising to refrain from any hostile action until sitting down at a negotiating table later this month to try and sort out differences. But in the past week, Greece has angered Turkey with what Ankara has billed a breach of that moratorium, a maritime agreement that Athens secretly clinched with Egypt, limiting Ankara's influence and energy designs in the region. As a result, Erdogan ordered out the Oruç Reis, sending it on its initial expedition, escorted by Turkish battleships, which Ankara has said it will use if Greece makes any attempt to block the vessel from its course. On Monday, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis chaired an urgent meeting of his National Security Council. A terse announcement issued after the hour-long meeting said officials had assessed the situation and reviewed Greece's response to any Turkish provocation, as they put it. Since then, Mitsotakis has also briefed leading European officials, and he is due to speak to the Secretary General of NATO, insisting, as his advisors tell VOA, that the US-led military alliance weigh in against Turkey. Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias, meantime, says Greece remains ready to sit down and talk with Turkey. We understand that Turkey has called off the talks, but I'm surprised it has done so, Dendias says. Maybe it is the result of some inexplicable rage, he said. We can only hope it comes back to its senses, Dendias said. The stakes are high, and Greece has warned it will use force to block any Turkish encroachment of its sea and land rights. Experts like Kostadinos Filis expect the crisis to escalate before it eases to any show of rapprochement. I expect the tension to grow in the coming days, but ultimately the fate of the feeble Turkish economy will weigh in on any final decision Erdogan will take, Fili says. If he feels Europeans are serious about their threats to retaliate, then he will probably think twice about making any risky moves. Then again, Fili says, Erdogan is extremely unpredictable, and if he feels he is cornered, he may ultimately go for a daring move to cater to his domestic audience alone. EU leaders have already threatened Turkey with economic sanctions. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. COVID-19 is raising concerns about the future of free travel across Europe. But as countries work to combat the virus spread with uncoordinated border restrictions, the EU Commission is warning a second wave of closures could cause more chaos, similar to what happened during the first outbreak in February that blocked traffic and medical equipment. Europe's economies have been battered by the disease, and the free movement of goods and people is vital to get them up and running again. The number of new COVID-19 cases among children in the United States rose 40% in the last 2 weeks of July, according to a report released just 2 weeks before tens of millions of American students are scheduled to begin the new school year. Health experts are keeping an eye on coronavirus infections among kids and teenagers. Long-awaited peace negotiations negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban are expected to start in Qatar within a week, once the final batch of Taliban prisoners are released. Afghanistan's president agreed Sunday to an agreement to release 400 hardcore Taliban prisoners, paving the way for talks aimed at ending a war that has ground on since U.S.-backed Afghan forces ousted the Taliban government in late 2001. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. To mark the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, the United Nations is calling for action to protect the cultural and political rights of Indigenous peoples at a time when COVID-19 poses a critical threat to their survival. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Many of the more than 476 million Indigenous people around the world now live in remote locations. Their traditional way of life and distance from heavily populated areas have largely insulated them from many diseases commonly circulating. However, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres notes that throughout history, Indigenous peoples have been decimated by diseases brought from elsewhere to which they had no immunity. Unfortunately, the coronavirus is following the same trajectory. The UN chief says the inequality, stigmatization, and discrimination to which Indigenous peoples are subjected are helping to spread the coronavirus through their communities. He says limited access to health care, clean water, and sanitation makes it difficult to contain the disease.
Indigenous peoples work primarily in traditional occupations and subsistence economies or in the informal sector. They have all been adversely affected by the pandemic. Indigenous women, who are often the main providers of food and nutrition for their families, have been particularly hard hit with the closure of markets for handicrafts, produce, and other goods.
The UN reports COVID-19 has infected more than 70,000 Indigenous people in the Americas, the epicenter of the pandemic. Among them, it says, are nearly 23,000 members of 190 Indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. More than 1,000 have lost their lives. The Amazon and other tropical forests that are home to Indigenous peoples have suffered environmental damage and economic deprivation. Guterres says these people are at the forefront in demanding environmental and climate action to protect their precious reserves.
Lapsed enforcement of environmental protections during the crisis has brought increasing encroachment on Indigenous peoples' territories by illegal miners and loggers. Many Indigenous people have been victims of threats and violence, and many have lost their lives in the face of such threats.
The United Nations says Indigenous peoples will have a better chance of tackling the coronavirus if they can exercise their rights to self-government and self-determination. The world body is calling for universal respect and protection of their inalienable rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And singer Sarah Bareilles will be acting in a new role as the opposite of who she really is. She'll be playing a washed-up musician. The NBC Universal streaming platform Peacock said Monday the Grammy-winning artist and Broadway songwriter will star in Girls Five Eva, co-produced by Tina Fey. The comedy is about a one-hit wonder girl group whose members reunite to give their pop star dreams one more shot. Bareilles will play a former member of the band who is now managing her family's small Italian restaurant in New York City. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.